If you would like to show more support for the podcast, you can do that by checking out the show's sponsor, Custom Reptile Habitats. There is an affiliate link in both the YouTube description and the show notes. If you do make a purchase through that link, a commission comes back to me at no extra cost to you. The other way you can show support to the podcast is through the Patreon account. For as little as 75 cents per episode, you will automatically be added to the Discord server so you can communicate and chat with other like-minded keepers. If you do bump yourself up to the $5 a month tier, you'll have early access to the episodes and the opportunity to submit questions to upcoming guests. Welcome back to the Animals at Home podcast. My name is Dylan Perrin, and thank you so much for tuning in today. Today I'm speaking with Benjamin Fabian, who is the human behind the Instagram account Draganthas Dragons. Benjamin is one of the most thorough and intelligent people I've had on the podcast, which you'll learn shortly once we get into this episode. He works with the genus Phrenosoma, which is horned lizards. Many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with horned lizards as they have this interesting dietary requirement for ants. They must eat ants even in captivity. And so we discussed the sort of the complexity of working with such a specialized species, but we discuss why Benjamin works with them, how he got into them, how he replicates nature and their natural history and their climate in captivity. But really, this is just an episode that lays out a perfect template for if you want to be a gold standing member of the herpetoculture community, because everything that Benjamin does and talks about in this episode will make you realize that's how much potential someone in the private sector has. He knows so much about these animals. He's been working with them for more than 2 decades and he's still young. So it's incredible. I can't imagine how much he will learn in the future. So again, we discuss this genus, the intricacies of caring for them in captivity. Of course, we delve deep into how he accomplishes feeding them ants in captivity, collecting ants in the wild and raising them in captivity, and how you actually feed ants to a lizard without them escaping into the room. It is a brilliant, fascinating conversation, and I know you'll enjoy it. Let's jump into it. Benjamin, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
I'm super excited. I mean, I love to talk to people who have this very, you know, specific focus when it comes to herpetoculture, and you're sort of taking it to another level just due to the species you're working with and some of the complexities, especially with the diet that anybody who's seen the thumbnail for this episode or the title talking about horned lizards, most people know that there's an ant requirement. So we're going to talk all about that, but that scares a lot of people, and it just goes to show how dedicated you are to the craft. Let's rewind the clock a little bit, give people some foundation of where you're coming from as far as the herpetoculture world goes. Have you been keeping reptiles for a long time?
I started at the age of 10. Before that, in my area, I was always around and then catching lizards. But after I catched my first lizard, I realized, okay, they drop off the tail. So I was more the observer. In my area, reptile keeping was not as common. So everyone had fish. So at the age of 6, I started with keeping fish. I was pretty fast to catch up and had an eye for some species I want to keep. So 2 years in, I was already breeding them. I was more specializing in South American dwarf cichlids like blue rams, epistogramma, some small catfish species, and was trading them at the local pet store. But they became pretty saturated over time, so they suggested me to go to a flea market for hobby breeders. Mm. It's more like a gymnasium in the local school where you go in, put in your table. So I started selling my fish there pretty quickly because it was not as common to have offspring from those species, and was roaming around. There were some people having bearded dragons, some of ball pythons, boa constrictors, and a lot of people with tarantulas. Mm. And also a stand with books and magazines. And then on the cover of one magazine, I was spotting the horned lizard, and it was nothing like I have seen before and immediately catched my interest. But then I was already hit with the first truck. Reptile keeping in the late 90s and in the early 2000s were wild. Mm-hmm. It's like somebody had placed the fear of everything from everything outside into the people's minds. So I was already told you can't keep them and they need ant acid and stuff like that. And the guy besides the table shouting, yeah, but they get imported every year in dozens. And I was like, okay, I know I was not getting far in terms of information from those two. So I was getting the magazine and a couple of books and immediately start researching. And the summer after, I got my first horned lizards and it stuck. until today.
Wow. Okay. That is actually not the answer that I was expecting. I was expecting, you know, the more typical thing and then getting into more mm-hmm. common species and then finding horned lizards along the way. But that's actually where you started.
Yeah. Wow. In my opinion, it doesn't really matter if you start with a more specialized species or a bearded dragon of some sorts, because every first animal you keep is a learning experience. And in some sorts, every animal is specialized in the environment it lives. It's evolution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so and that's a great point.
Yeah. So for me, it was not a way really to get a substitute, because I was already interested in that species, and that drove my learning experience and stems the foundation to what I've become right now with the species.
So what year was it when you first acquired your first one?
It was rough. They were in pretty bad shape. But over a long run, I was already having some experience with them from breeding alone. So I gave them water. And unlike everyone telling me everything from outside is bad, they're telling that to a kid who already dumped stuff from outside for years in his fish tanks, like alder cones, leaf litter, wood. I was getting ants from outside. They recovered pretty quickly. In terms of light, I never had really a problem. I already had metal halides and incandescent bulbs from my fish tanks. The one thing I had to acquire was a mercury vapor bulb for a little bit of UVB. In the summer, I placed them outside. So the basics were already there. And I think fish keeping helped me to understand that it's more an animal you have to observe than handle.
Yeah, yeah. Do you remember what year it was when you first acquired your first one?
Yeah, 99.
Oh, that was 99. Okay, wow. Yeah. So you've been doing this for 25 years.
Yeah, almost 25 years, yeah.
And during that 25-year span, have you only kept horned lizards, or have you dabbled in other species as well?
I had to keep other species because when I was turning 18, after my first education, I was starting at a pet store. So I was more or less responsible for fish and seawater, freshwater, and the pond section. But they kept or they recognized that I already kept horned lizards. So they drove me a little bit more in that direction. And we had a lot of rescues. So I was getting supported to keep them there and also educate customers and stuff like that, and already made exams. In Europe, you can make exams like it's called paragraph 11. It's from the government and natural conservation. You can say that some sorts. So you have a basic knowledge that enables you to keep and sell different kinds of species. Mm. And over the years, I kept the most common, and also some I had interest in because of. Because the problem was I already had the knowledge of the horned lizards, but not from the predators. So I already had I had interest in king snakes and some predators that were roaming around that.
Gotcha.
But yeah, all sorts of animals back then.
It is. I mean, you seem so young to say that you have 25 years of experience working with one, you know, genre of animals is really wild. You know, that's crazy.
Yeah, it's cool, but also on the other hand, you get looked down a lot. So when Facebook and stuff like that came and I was entering groups, I was suddenly surrounded by people way older than me telling me everything I do is wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, yeah. Can I ask how old you are?
I'm 34.
Oh, you're 34. Okay. So
yeah,
I'm turning
35.
Yeah, yeah. You look, I thought you were maybe a little bit younger than me. I'm 32, but so that makes sense. So you would have been, you know, in... 10 or 11, or maybe 12 when you first got into them initially?
It was 10, 11. That's some sorts, yeah.
So I'm curious about this because, you know, there's a big difference between seeing an interesting animal on the cover of a magazine mm-hmm. and then going through that research phase and then actually acquiring the animal. I imagine that most people would be turned, you know, a horned lizard looks incredible, but then you start researching, you realize, okay, there's a big ant requirement. That's going to be a massive turnoff to people. I'm curious to know why that wasn't a turnoff for you. And then I also would love to know what it was like when you first actually laid your eyes on the real thing. Was that a pretty exciting experience?
Oh yeah, it was like a dream came true. I was always fascinated with dragons per se, from video games, from Pokemon at that time. So they were the closest to an actual dragon besides the trivial name of the bearded dragon. They were actually like a dragon. So I was already a year in my research because I had to wait until the next batch were imported. And then I was asking around in local zoos and stuff like that. And a month after I got them, I catched some conversation about a guy in Switzerland already keeping and breeding horned lizards since the 70s, and nobody told me. And he released a book in 1998. I was getting that book in just 2000, which is how I always have it by my side.
Wow.
So it was from Bernd Bauer. And it's already my third one. It's falling apart. And then some more information got out to me. So I was already able to connect the dots I already had in mind with scientific evidence. So I knew I was on a good path, and it was a real help because in the third year, I had them. I was actually start breeding them regularly. The first 2 years were more like an experiment. I had some stuff wrong with rumination. Rumination was too warm. Incubation was wrong. So that was a big help at that time.
And then the ants piece, just even the research phase before you acquired them, that didn't scare you. How come?
Because I was surrounded by ants. It was
simple.
Yeah, it was so simple. Everyone told me stuff from outside is bad, but those animals live in environments way harsher than I have at home. So I was going out to our garden because I knew we had no pollution or stuff like that. Getting ants, 6 months later, I had my first eggs. It was pretty easy for me.
Amazing. So for those who are totally unfamiliar with the genus, can we run through just some of the basics that, you know, as a bird's eye view of this genus?
So there are about 20 recognized species. You can find them in North and Central America. The range is from the edge of Canada over the southwest down to Mexico, Baja California, and then a population on the tip of Guatemala. They are in a variety of different habitats, mostly around ants, where ant populations are. They occupy areas with loose or sandy soils, but sometimes also dry riverbed, lush forests. We have shrublands, grasslands, also volcanic areas. So they are adapted to our environment pretty much in every way. But all of the species prefer to have a similar body shape. So evolution catched pretty early on them, and they developed as surrounding ants in the environment.
And how large are they? Because they're fairly small, if I'm knowing correctly.
Oh, they are big ones. They are big ones. The Phrynosoma asio is the Mexican great horned lizard. They get from head to vent 12 centimeters. The other, between that, we have also varieties of different sizes. So between 3 centimeters head to vent to about 12 centimeters, we have everything between them.
Gotcha. And their actual sort of body plan does look somewhat similar, I guess, across all species. Like you said, evolution kind of kicked in pretty early with them, but there's a size difference and I'm sure some color, you know, some variations like that.
Yeah. Typically, the color variation is determined by the surroundings they have. They are pretty good at camouflage. They are adapted at all sorts of environments. Their back is also made like sandpaper. So after a shed, they cover themselves with the substrate and blend in more into the environment. They also have a row, or some species have two rows of fringe scales around the sides. So they eliminate every shadow. If they press themselves down to the substrate, you can't see them.
That's amazing. And that's so what awesome. And people will see either if they're watching this on Spotify or YouTube or, you know, going to your Instagram page after. The most eye-catching thing about your page is how beautiful you've, you know, recreated those environments. So I really want to talk about that as well. But, you know, that's one of the fascinating things about keeping a species like this is getting to replicate some of that in captivity. How many species have you or do you work with or have you worked with over the years?
I'm on the 8 now. Okay. At the moment, I have only 2 species I work with because of limited space. But over the years, I have kept and bred 7, and now I'm with the Texas horned lizard, and I'm in the 8.
And are they fairly, as you said, they have quite a large geographic range, and I'm sure that's species specific. So do you actually cater their care differently based off the species, or are you kind of following a similar template across all species?
Depending on the density of population, I know where they were imported because of the regulations in the USA. So adjacent areas are more or less the same, but I go after a baseline. I go into the specific care of every animal. Mexican species, you can keep them much more like a frog or a bearded dragon. They are more tropical. Desert species need a little bit more arid, loose soil, a little bit lower in humidity and average humidity, but also with sorts of microclimates. And depending on the species, I incorporate different sorts of structures and brushes. For example, Texas horned lizard has a dedicated stripe on its back, which helps simulate a dried grass. And then I just put in dry grass so they can camouflage a little bit more.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk a little bit about just doing research for this, because this is something that you're quite good at, is doing research on a species that doesn't have a ton of information. And like, where do you start? How do you do it properly? How do you make sure that you're acquiring the right information?
I think it's important to also research the environment. So I start with research, and it doesn't matter for me if I have this, if I had a species of horned lizard or I'm getting a new one. I always start over with my research so I can catch up. I usually go over the density of population. Where's the highest density? Because that tells me, okay, there's most likely the most suitable conditions. And then I start with researching the environment first. I look at environmental studies. I look at geographical studies, agriculture. I look at plants. Then I look at the soil and the composition of that. I look at predators. And also what kind of ants or other invertebrates are there. And then at the last point, then I research the animal itself.
Mm. So you start with this sort of foundation of the earth that it's being surrounded by, whether that's predators, prey, and climate.
Absolutely, because that's what evolution does. We have the environment with most likely all its predators and the food source, and the animal has to adapt to it. So for me, it is a logical conclusion to look in the environment first, and then seek out what's the animal's needs.
Something like population density, are you just getting that from academic papers written on this the genus? Okay.
I read about 50 to 100 papers in a couple of months, so I'm pretty picky on information. I do my own research. Also look at all different kinds of topics. It's not just about an environment. I look at botanical studies, geographical studies. It's you can compare a study made from a geologist with a study made on the environment by a biologist. There's two different kinds of people with two different mindsets. The one looks after the animal first. The other looks after the stones and the gravel and the substrate. It's much more like you have different light sources which are good at one thing and you combine them. That's basically what I do.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great point. And the thing is when you're at the end of the day, you're doing research for husbandry for an animal, but you almost have to completely get rid of once you've identified the area, you have to delete the animal from your brain almost. And that, because that really hampers what you're going to use as resources if you're trying to attach those resources to that specific animal.
Exactly. I want to recreate the environment without the factors of a predator or without the factors of without the bad factors, let's say so, and then I put the animal in. It's also like a habit I picked up from fish keeping. I first set up the environment, looked that everything is right, and then I introduced the animal.
And as I said, it's so clear that you do that because the enclosures are set up so well and that the animals look like, it does really look like a piece of nature. So why don't we discuss just a little bit of the husbandry, and we'll save the ants for later because I think that's quite a speed bump to cover. But let's just discuss the basics of, you know, enclosure size and lighting and whatnot.
So I'm more specialized in the desert dwelling species, or more arid, you can say. So for the middle-sized species, like the most common is the desert horned lizard in captivity, and after that it's the Phrynosoma solara, the regal horned lizard. I usually go with a standard 4x2x2, and then I do the substrate. I incorporate a drainage layer so that excess water can drain down. I usually try to build up rock formations, but on old bricks, so the animals can't undermine them. They dig a lot, and then I start to mix my substrate. So in the layers over the drainage, I usually go with a mix of topsoil, organic topsoil, of course, sand, clay, and peat moss. So the moisture gets retained, but after a given threshold, it gets sucked up by the drainage. And over that, I incorporate something like a clays and clay sand mixture that lets pass through the moisture, but also keeps the environment sort of dry, so the animals can dig in. And on top of that, I usually put in gravel and what matches the markings of my animals. So I also study the local range and try to incorporate that. For my desert horned lizards, it's more a little bit of leaf litter and fine gravel, or I like to use the Exotel product, the stone desert, because it's a pretty good foundation. From that, I try to source plants from the native range. If I can't if I can't find them, I try to raise them myself or find a substitute. And it's more or less like a composition of different materials to match the actual environment.
Gotcha. And for the drainage layer, what are you using? Mm-hmm. And then are you separating it with a screen, or because they are quite they like to dig, do you kind of leave the screen out?
I leave the screen out, but I use a mixture of leaker balls and volcanic stone or lava gravel, because the leaker stone is good at releasing a little bit of the moisture. The lava gravel holds it a little bit more, so I want to have the functionality of both.
And eventually, I imagine that it mixes with the actual like finer substrate.
Yeah, of course. That's why I usually go with a little bit bigger of the lava rock. The problem, and that's something I had in fish tanks as well, is if you mix different gravel sorts or sand, they try to compact and get hard. And that's what I want to a little bit to counteract. Right. I also incorporate a hose, a silicone hose, over the whole length of the enclosure, so I can put in water from outside to rehydrate the deeper levels of substrate, so that plants can access them, and it also can help with rehydrate the soil itself in the upper layers.
Okay, that's interesting. So you just have like a tube that goes underneath into the drainage layer, so you can water basically the base layer without having to soak the topsoil.
Exactly. That's something I developed over the years.
Do you mist at all on top as well?
Yeah.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Once a week I mist, because I have live plants in it, and it's also a natural way of rehydrating for the lizards itself. They lick it from the stones, from the gravel, from all of the decorations, even from the walls of the enclosure. So rain harvesting for them is a central functionality in the wild. So I usually spray them once a week.
Will they use a water dish at all?
They will. Also, my Texas horned lizards, they jump in the water dish. And one day I came from work and looked at all three of them in a water dish looking at me. I was like, okay, I get robbed right now. It's a hilarious picture.
That's awesome. And then what about lighting? You know, desert species, I'm sure there's you have a lot running on top.
Oh, they need a lot of light. There's a lot of hormone-based functions they need to with the light. I usually go in as much light as I can. I have metal halides, LEDs, and all sorts of different light sources to match natural spectrum as far as close as I can. The problem with the standard 4x2x2 is they get easily overheated.
Right.
So that's, in summer, I have to get rid of the LED or put in a low wattage metal halide. That's why I also try to build new enclosures. I also have to put in some ventilation with PC fans and something like that, or I have to take out the glass and put in half glass glass, so I have a little bit more airflow.
Right. Yeah, that is a challenge with a species that's going to need a lot of light, even if it's not a heat,
oh, yeah,
specific heat light or lamp, it's going to still put off a ton of heat.
Yeah, that's a problem. And I think most standard enclosures are not suitable for species like that. You need to have a fairly deep substrate layers. I usually go with 10 to 20 centimeters at minimum. But realistically, you need to have 30 to 40 centimeters, which matches the actual studies from the desert.
Right. And then as far as actual, like the temperatures that you're aiming for, just maybe ambient during the day and a warm spot, what do you shoot for?
Actual ambient between 30 and 32.
Okay.
If we go not for power density, but for surface measurements, I go with usually between 48 and 50 degrees on the sunspot, where all lamps match, and on the shadier side between 28 and 30 is okay, because the animals, with a proper setup, the animals can thermoregulate through the substrate or go in the shade or use the microclimates I offer.
And do you worry about measuring humidity at all, or do you just do the one mist a week and just go from there?
I do the one mist a week. Because that also matches with the weather data, and with the deep substrate layer, I usually have a good hydration. If during the hot months, I give them directly water through a small pipette or syringe, because that's when with the standard size enclosures you get a little bit more problems. And in Germany, it can get really hot. I'm in the south part of Germany, on the border of French. On the French border, so it gets really hot. They have to counteract a little bit.
Yeah, that makes sense. So up until that point, the base care for these guys is relatively straightforward. For I think most people would agree that, you know, it, as just kind of similar to any arid species, but we take a steep left turn when we get into the diet. So let's talk about their requirements, and I'd love to know the theories behind why the ants are something they need, or if there's an answer to that, I'd be curious to know, or what are some of the suggestions that people say that are the reason for that, and then we'll get into how you're actually accomplishing this.
There's an easy answer and a more elaborate one. The easy answer would be, okay, ants are more available, even under the harshest conditions. The more elaborate is that they evolved around ants. There's this persisting urban legend that they would eat the ants to regulate their stomach acidity, to counteract parasites, or they need the acidity to regulate all sorts of internal organs, something like that. But that's completely wrong. We know from research that a lot of ants in the native range all don't produce any acid. It's more about other contents of the ant, like ants are rich in fiber, calcium, protein. They have no carbohydrates. They contain about 584 amino acids and albumin, which is in blood serum responsible for transporting fatty acids and calcium and also binding toxins. The problem with ants is that because they have no carbohydrates, and horned lizards don't need a long period of rest like crocodilians after a large meal, they need to eat a lot more. So they developed a stomach that's about 13% larger compared to other lizards.
Interesting, which is really a fascinating adaptation for a reptile, considering that typically they're used to a much slower metabolism and they can get away with eating a lot less. And obviously there have been people in the past who have acquired these and then attempted to not feed them ants. What happens when they go about that?
They die. They simply die. You can think of it, if they are not having a proper diet, they will get all sorts of sicknesses. You can also think of a horned lizard like a diabetical species. They need ants to also process other food because of some sorts of the ants. The problem with common feeder insects is that they have a widespread thin chitinous layer and carbohydrates, and the calcium phosphor balance is way off. So if they are fed and continuous diet with most likely mealworms or crickets, they will get kidney failure, liver failure, and they die, and they can't process the fatty acids or the chitin.
Right. You're just forcing them to do to eat a diet that they're actually not adapted to. And it's so fascinating because so many reptile species are quite generalists when it comes to what they're able to eat. You know, snakes and even lizards have a pretty wide prey variety that they can typically consume. So to find something that has, assumably they're eating lots of different species of ants, but it's still within one band of insect that they can eat.
Yeah, they eat most likely harvester ants, because it's the most common in North America, but they also have some sorts of species of different ants. The invasive fire ants, they only eat the queens if offered them, but it's also a problem with conservation over there, because the fire ant also eats harvester ants, despite having one of the most potent toxins or venoms in the animal kingdom.
Right. So how does the venom affect as they ingest these harvester ants? Does that affect the lizards at all?
That's so genius. We know from research that, of course, harvester ants have one of the most potent venoms. In toxicology, the medium lethal dose or LD50 value is something you can use to determine the toxicity of a given substance. For harvester ants, the venom is so well researched. We know that the LD50 factor is about 0.12 milligrams on a kilogram, which translates that 12 stings can kill a 2 kilogram rat.
Wow,
that's really potent. I have a small colony of harvester ants. The pain is unbearable. I got stung by one. It's nothing I want to repeat in terms of experience. But horned lizards have a blood factor in serum that neutralizes the venom completely. And in terms of comparison of the rat, they are about 1,500 times more resistant to the venom than the rat.
Wow. Because presumably they get bit all the time.
Stung and bit all the time. But they also have, in terms of swallowing, it's just one neutralization from outside. But overexposure will, of course, kill them. But from the terms of eating, they developed such a unique way of disabling the ant's defensive mechanism itself. They have a sticky tongue, much like chameleons. And when they swallow the ant, they cover it in mucus. So they cover it, disable all the defensive mechanisms, and then gain the soluble nutrients and components of the abdomen of the ant. The thick chitinous layer, they can process, or it's no needed to process, they throw it out. So that's how, in comparison, they need to eat about 200 ants to get on the same level as, for example, the colored lizard eating two locusts or crickets.
I'd like to take a quick break to thank today's show sponsor, Temascus Limited. Many of you are probably already familiar with Temascus, as the founder has been on the podcast before. That's Thomas Griffiths. Last summer, we did a podcast called The Fundamentals of Lighting. And if you are any way confused by lighting, you must go listen to that episode because we break it down in very simplistic terms. Temascus is an independent animal and husbandry consultant, as well as a research and development consultant. Thomas works behind the scenes to help improve lighting technology for everything from just a keeper like you and I, all the way up to really high-level zoos. Thomas has an incredible amount of experience from testing lighting technology all the way to actually making sure it's implemented properly in the field, which makes him uniquely positioned to give lighting advice for animals in captivity. He works with all taxa, ranging from small reptiles and amphibians all the way up to large mammals. He is trusted by zoos, vets, and the world's leading manufacturers. This allows him to offer professional and friendly advice tailored specifically to your needs, knowledge, and budget. Temascus also covers continued professional development and training for those of you who work in a pet store, a vet clinic, or a zoo environment, and all advice given is protected by insurance. Thomas is available for both in-person and virtual consultations. If you are looking for more information on Temascus, make sure you head to temascus.com. That is T-O-M-A-S-K-A-S.com. Wow. So it's a lot more work. So how do they acquire them in the wild? Are they just sitting next to anthills and digging through them?
Yeah, exactly. You can find horned lizards most likely around or in the surroundings of anthills. That's also a way why, that's also in terms of evolution, that's why they developed such secretive behaviors. Because ants are way farther out in terms of their in terms of exposure in the heat than other invertebrates, so they had to find ways to sit on an anthill and leisurely lick those ants out without getting caught by predators. That's why they developed those tank-like bodies and be able to blend in with the surroundings. So, and they are more resistant to heat than other lizards, for example. So they can have longer exposure levels in the sun while eating their food.
That's incredible. I mean, when you think about the evolutionary process, obviously it's a chicken versus the egg situation, but you have this animal that's sort of committing to eating ants and the rest of its body is adapting to make that continue to happen. You know, in response to incredibly hot heat and predators that could just come pluck them off the anthill, they develop all these weapons to allow them to continue to gorge 200 ants a day.
Yeah, the whole lizard is adapted. It's almost like they are over-engineered.
Yeah.
Even if they get spotted, they have a lots more of defensive mechanisms. Some sorts of horned lizards can shoot blood out of their eyes. Which is mostly a defense mechanism against canine predators. They can puff up themselves and make them bigger. They can also make them extremely flat and play dead. And if they get swallowed, they even have the horns.
Right.
So they were found roadrunners were dead with a horned lizard in the throat, pierced by the horns.
Wow. So yeah, they're not an appetizing meal for most predators.
Absolutely not. They are so adapted in the environment. It's incredible.
That is really amazing. So, you know, you had mentioned that they actually won't eat fire ants, which are invasive and are slowly taking over the harvester ants. So when you first started working with them, you said you were surrounded by ants outside, but I guess it's not really a slam dunk that they're going to eat the ants that are native to you. Was it pretty much they took to them right away, or did you have to work on introducing that specific ant species to them as a diet?
They usually take all ants I offer them, but I also have to make research on the ants itself because I have to find some sorts of different ants that match the nutrient level for the harvester ants or what their evolutionary needs is. The problem I had at first is when I introduced ants to them, I just put them in a small bowl and they were scattering around the enclosure, so they were pretty scattered first. That's when I started to develop those ant feeders. First, I put in a small flower pot. They usually have this this hole for drainage on the underside and put that over the ants, so not all ants get out immediately. That's when I was first trying to replicate an anthill from the wild. I was also try to introduce something like the yellow meadow ant, which is pretty common around here. It's an ant that lives most of the time under the surface, so it's more adapted to it's more calm. That was not scurrying around and scaring the ants. So the first time introducing ants to the actual horned lizard, it was tough, but I made it through.
Yeah, I can only imagine. For me, when I feed crickets, I just get annoyed at how easy they can be to escape. But they're so large and they're easy to find, and you know they make a noise, so you go see them. But I can only imagine what it would be like to like throw a bunch of ants into an enclosure and just watch them infest the place.
Yeah, my wife don't likes it. last night we found one of the ants crawling at the ceiling, and she was giving me the looks.
Yeah.
Also, why I would need to make new enclosures
to keep them ant proof.
I have to keep them ant proof. Also, ants that are not in the enclosure not get eaten, which throws off my whole diet plan.
Right. So you have. It sounds like you have a group of ants that you're working with and culturing on your own. And then do you still wild collect your ants?
Yeah.
And even if you aren't, so can you tell us that process? And then we'll get into the ones that you're culturing. How do you go out and it seems pretty obvious you probably just scoop them up, but is there a tactic that you use?
I have different tactics on different ants. Most ants that live underneath, I can just take a shovel and bucket and sort them out. Then there are ants that are more aggressive. In terms of intervening in the daily cycle, so I have made a vacuum cleaner. It's a hand cleaner with a small jar on it and a valve that can suck up the ants and then introduce them into the enclosure, which also is preferable to me because I don't have to collect the earth itself,
right,
and destroy the ant burrow.
That way you probably feel a little bit less guilty. You can just suck them up. And but if they have to eat so many ants a day, how are you constantly, is this like a daily thing that you have to go outside and collect ants, or you do it every day?
Right now I do it every day because it's still a little bit cold outside and my animals woke up earlier than expected. In summer I can usually go once a week. But horned lizards are a species you have to dedicate yourself to it because you're most of the time in the summer, you're out collecting ants. And if you, for example, have other species beside that, you're also, for example, a monitor. You have also play with the monitor to have it mentally stable. It's something I never can keep besides of horned lizards, but I am also not interested in keeping monitors.
Mm. Yeah, but that is the commitment level. It is something is only something a reptile keeper would do, by the way. It's just commit to like a forever ant collection.
During New Year's Eve, they woke up because we had a warm spell. So I was out there, minus 10 degrees, scooping up ants 50 centimeters under the surface.
Wow. So I assume by your home, there's like a place that you regularly go to?
I have multiple places because I don't want to overcollect because it's something I need to do for at least 50, 60 years in terms of how long I actually live. So I have different places of where I can scoop ants out, and then I usually go to one place a year, or if we are on a road trip, I collect ants there too. And I also have a friend which runs an ant store here in Germany, so he can also give me some here and there from his big leaf cutter colonies. And I also breed them myself. But
so
it's,
when you bring the wild caught ones inside, are those going immediately into enclosures to be fed, or do you put them in containers and keep them for a while before feeding them?
I usually go out with a couple of containers. There are the those Drosophila fruit fly containers with the lid and the mesh. I usually use them because sometimes I have way smaller ants than others, and they can immediately get out if I have a larger spread mesh. So I usually have them and keep them in the crawl space I have, on the side, so they're a little bit cooler and hold out longer.
Gotcha. So then let's talk about the ones that you actually breed and culture yourself. Mm-hmm. What species is that, and how do you do that?
I have a couple of ant farms, and the most I breed are the European harvester ant, because I want to give them the opportunity to have a similar diet as in the wild. And I also have the red harvester ant, Pogonomyces barbatus, but those colonies are 2 years in, and they are really slow in producing workers. They eventually get really big, but those first 3 or 4 years are just keeping and breeding them. And on occasions, or when I'm not able to go out, I usually pick up from those farms and introduce them to my home lizard.
Gotcha. And then you'd already mentioned sort of simulating an anthill in the enclosure, but the ant feeder now seems like you've kind of nailed it. Can you describe that to people maybe who are just listening, how that functions and how the lizards respond to it?
I usually strive for a minimal interaction setup, which I think is the best way to keep reptiles. I also don't like the enclosures. The animals can always see me and are distracted. So my way over the years, I had different prototypes, and now we have our own place and I can do as I will. I put in the enclosures in a stationary place and drill the hole from outside, feeding, attaching a container, which I smeared over the lid with talcum powder so the ants can get out, and are forcing to get over the hose inside into my actual ant feeder, which I used for years. In this container, the only way out is over the stick, and that's simulating the anthill. And their response to it is exceptional, because I was able, through that ant feeder, and they're not seeing me actually putting the food in it, to see natural behavior. They are way calmer, way more occupied. And it's something I am, from the video, I already got responses from herpetologists who actually live in that area and say what I do is nearly that what they see in the wild. But even then, I'm not satisfied. I want to make it way more like the actual desert.
How do you have an idea of how you might do that?
Oh yeah, I actually planned out. We are right now fixing the roof, so all of the rooms are in renovation. But after that, I built new enclosures that are more like tubs, which are 1 square meter and then 70 centimeters height, with a lid on top, and also an open style outdoor enclosure, or a turtle tub. You see it. I actually got on the idea from Philip Leeds, Arids Only.
Yeah.
He uses dead tubs, and it seems to work really fine. So I was kind of thinking like I do that as well, which enables me to put in way more light, because I don't have a closed box that's overheating. And then also can give my animals more space, a much deeper substrate layer. And then I try to go with absolutely no interaction setup besides retrieving eggs and spot cleaning.
Wow. So then you'd have basically ants being fed into that enclosure all the time?
From outside, I will introduce a well. I can open and close from outside, put in ants. Actually put in the ant farm on the enclosure, or different styles of containers I can put in from outside, so the animals don't have to see me. I actually want to have the same expression from the enclosures, like the pictures I see from the wild. I also want my animals to have more of the wild response, and not being used to me giving them food. I want them more wild, because I think If I trigger more wild or more natural behavior, it also will help with breeding, that initial response to reproduce because of a predatory intruder.
Yeah. So I want to talk about the breeding process as well, but I also want to talk about why. Let's just talk about the process of breeding first, and then I really want to dig into, you know, what's motivating you to keep the as wild as possible and reproduce these. So as far as, you know, you've been breeding them for 2 decades now, what are some things that are keys in order to make this successful?
Usually for the most species, it determines if you can breed them the year before. The brumation has to be on top. They need those periods of rest because during that time, it's not only a sleeping mechanism. They develop the some of the bone structure. They also develop sperm and eggs, or the initial response to that. Also, it's also a key if you fed them the diet properly. And gotcha. After brumation, it usually goes into waking up and breeding. During that time, I separate males from females. In nature, males are usually up first because they need to build strength for the mating and also for competitor displaying and then stuff like that. So in the first 4 or 6 weeks, I have them separated.
Are they normally kept in colonies?
You can keep them. It's the only species you can, which is from scientific research, where males are not aggressive against each other. So it usually helps if you have more males because then there is something like a competition.
Mm.
And the dominant male gets reproduced. And in terms of breeding, I have to switch out males because I want to have a stable bloodline over the years.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. And then incubation, I'm sure, is pretty straightforward.
Yeah. For desert species, you usually go between 26 and 28 degrees Celsius. For the Mexican or the highland species, you usually go for the egg-laying species because we have live bearers as well.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
You usually go with 25 degrees. So the time I had the Mexican species, I had Asian orbiculare. One of them is a live bearer. One of them is eggling. I usually incubated them between 25 to 26 degrees with success.
Gotcha. And then how about the baby rearing? I imagine, mm-hmm. Do they take the ants right away? Is there any issues with that?
Smaller ant species, they take as well. The problem with rearing of hatchlings is they don't have those defense mechanisms. Like the adults, and then they also have a really high need of humidity, because in the wild they hatch out of a burrow with almost 90 to 100% humidity, and the first instinct is everyone wants to eat me, so they hide between grasses, and they usually find in the first weeks termites and small ant species, and until a month or two when they are a little bit bigger, then they go also on harvester ants. And a hatchling can feed on harvester ants because a hatchling is almost the size of a harvester ant, depending on the species.
Really? So that's me. I didn't realize how small they were, but also how big harvester ants are.
They can fit on a penny if they hatch.
Wow. Oh my God.
I bred a species, which is the round-tailed hawk lizard. It's one of the smaller species. If you're familiar with Tic Tac candies, the eggs are that size.
Are you serious?
I was scared to dig them out. I was there with a little scoop and I was screaming because I don't wanted them. They are simulating in the wild. Those species are simulating little rocks. They curl themselves up and also mimic a little bit of the color like chameleons. And you can find them because they look like a little rock.
That's amazing. That definitely adds a challenge. I mean, if they're that small coming out of the egg, then, you know, it's a whole other ball of wax as far as feeding and just keeping them in something that they're not going to get out of and maintaining proper humidity and climate.
I usually go with concrete mixing tubs because they're a little bit high on humidity, and then I put it on with live grass and straw and cork bark, and I spray them in the first few weeks. I spray them more frequently. And then after the third or second or third shed, they usually have a more thicker outer layer and bury themselves a little bit more so they can cover with substrate, which also protects a little bit more from radiation.
Yeah. Okay, that makes sense. So anybody listening can understand, A, how brilliant you are. It's incredible, all the work that you've done and all the research that you've done and how, you know, keeping that all in your head, but also the dedication that you have for something like this is pretty outstanding. So I'm curious, what's motivating you to, A, work with such a complex species or group of species, and then B, why are you so, like, that need to keep that wild experience authentic to the animal, where does that come from for you?
I always admired people trying to replicate natural environments. I first got introduced them with the fish keeping. I was surrounded by fish keepers. Some of them were keeping a lot of cool species in natural environments. I always had that picture in mind. I want to see the animal in a lifelike environment, from taken out from nature. I also got a lot of backlash back then. Also, my foster parents got a lot of backlash why they were allowing me to keep such a highly specialized species and do me as I wish. But I already had 4 years experience and I did well with fish. So there were no doubt I did good. Over the years, with introducing a Facebook and social media and working at a pet shop, I got to introduce the other side of the extreme, with really bad keepers, bad advice, keeping plushed animals under a heat lamp and carpet, and free roaming animals with dogs, and which strengthened that resolve more, more strengthened that resolve that I also that I want to keep or act as a role model with this species in a nature-like environment. Also, some sorts to counteract, like substrate is bad, wood is bad, and everything from outside is bad and cause infection, which we all know is to improper husbandry. And I also think if you keep a species like that, that's so misunderstood and over decades were forced to die because people think and as it from the pharmacy is the way, and also companies putting out minerals, mineral powders with antacid, which is a pretty renowned company that does a lot of good food for other reptiles. But I know the dark number of horned lizards that died in the process of testing this, which is also something that made me furious.
Is there any success with that
No,
supplement at all?
absolutely not. It's because of the rumor of the antacid, to get back to the that thing, it was it's some sort of needed, but also not. Horned lizards have the biochemical process functionality of called catalytic hydrolysis. Under extreme circumstances, they can use antacid to break down moisture from minerals, and then retire the minerals through organ. Through the nostrils and use the moisture. But in captivity, where water is plenty, you don't need that functionality in proper care. The rumor spread it, and people, like urban legends are, with other reptiles as well, spread it around, and it was so manifested. But we also had this genius man in Switzerland already producing hatchlings for 30 years, and nobody told me. And this urban legend still persists even in well-known YouTubers' feature on these lizards. And I think it's my responsibility as a keeper and actual breeder, because I don't want to introduce this breeder. I'm more a conservative, more a natural keeper that wants to preserve the animal. I think it's a very responsibility if you work with such a highly specialized species and have success with it to release that information so that conservation environments like Fort Worth Zoo, Tinker Air Force Base, Horned Lizard Conservation Foundation can access those information to stabilize or reintroduce wild populations. So if I have the opportunity to go into the wild, I actually can see horned lizards in the wild.
That I think that's a great answer. I mean, like you said, you want to be the source of the information for these animals, and you know you're probably one of the, if not the most experienced person in the world, almost working with these animals in captivity, considering how long you've done it for and how few people actually do it. It's such a bad thing in herpetoculture for these little myths to just continue on, and then you have people who actually don't work with the species who are just saying that because they heard somebody else say that, and then you know it just continues to develop, where someone like yourself who actually works with them, and I'm sure the gentleman in Switzerland as well, is not using, you know, magic dust to get these things to feed. You're actually just doing the work of collecting ants and feeding ants and knowing that that is what works.
Yeah, and from him and from his research, and also from Waitsi Sherbrooke, which in the United States is one of the top foremen in terms of horned lizards, their research helped me a lot because I only have the experience of keeping them inside, but I also can use that experience to give them feedback if they are in need
Right.
of reproducing them in the wild or on, under closed circumstances. And I think keeping this kind of species also helps other people in the reptile hobby to overthink their keeping a little bit, and also helps people who actually have, and there are a lot of people who keep horned lizards, to rethink their husbandry, because that's what I do every day. Every day I sit here and think, what can I do better? I go to research, what can I develop, and develop from there, because for me the animal comes first. And that's something my wife also knows. If my animals are not in good shape, I'm also not in good shape, because I always think, okay, what can I do? What I did wrong, or what can I do better?
And I think there's a tendency for humans just in general to be fascinated in something and then learn that there's an element to that thing that is challenging. And then the first thing we often do is, okay, how do we get around that challenge? And so you have people that really want to keep a horned lizard, and instead of figuring out, okay, how do we raise an ants and feed ants, they go, what's the next easiest thing I can do that's not feeding ants? And it's just a terrible solution.
Yeah, exactly. And then I don't understand people that are willingly going through such high efforts just to avoid going out. And most people's having success with horned lizards are also having urogastrics, because they are forced to go out to get food. So it's like Kamel Hemmerse. He also keeps horned lizards because he has to go out and collect food for his urogastrics. So it's just a step on the right or on the left to get ants.
Now, what about just, you are breeding them, and presume, I'm not sure, are you selling them to people, or how do you take that responsibility? Because you are bringing in pretty complicated animals into the herpetoculture community. How do you process that?
I usually go with a short interview. I'm not really into selling them. I don't want to put a value on those animals, and since they are not getting imported, and some breeders are trying to capitalize on them, the prices are pretty high. For example, I don't like I talked about money. For my Texas horned lizards, I had to sell my DLSR with a couple of lenses to get them. It was a one-time deal. It was a random clutch. The female died from the keeper. It was a now or nothing
So you sold your
situation.
camera to get them.
Yeah, to get them.
Wow.
And for me, it's more like I want to trade with other keepers. I want to share experience. I want to get a stable population, so I can long term also have my little studies. I want to make nothing that harms the animal, but I also want to get more into the substrate camouflage thing, and introduce them to different colors of substrate, and want to challenge them to cover themselves a little bit more with that over time, and also how they respond to different kinds of ants introduced. But my long-term goal is to have a stable population of horned lizards. At that time, because of limited space, I only have two species. I want to get three more back and stop there.
You don't
Because
see yourself getting tired of working with this genus.
no,
That's
it's the only
amazing.
genus I keep and I want to keep. Since I was the 10-year-old kid, it was more I was more feeling bad for the other species I had to keep for my work, because I was absolutely not interested in them. It was more like a nuisance to me, but I kept them as bad as I could, and when they were catching up with health, I got them back to the store and resold them to good homes. But for me, it was always and will be always horned lizards.
Well, I think just this conversation in general leaves a good template for people, whether they want to get into keeping horned lizards or anything else that's complicated, to see like how deep you can go. And there's really no there's no bottom to how far you can take a species as far as trying to replicate nature in a captive setting.
Yeah, absolutely. We just covered the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, it just continues to go.
But yeah, absolutely. I can go all day. But I think for most people, if they look at, for example, my pictures on Instagram, I always put in a little anecdote of information on there. Because I don't want to put out a cute picture of my animal. I want to educate people. Mm-hmm. Educating is such a bad word. I want to give out information on these lizards.
Well, and you just wrote an article for Exotic Keeper magazine as well, which is, you know, a pretty thorough article that goes into a lot of the base care, including ants and whatnot. And I think that if anyone's interested in the species on a deeper level, that's a great place to start as well.
Yeah, two more are coming.
Oh, you have two more articles coming.
I sent Thomas two more and already working on three more.
Okay, awesome. So those will be a series. It'll just continue to carry on with the series.
I will carry on with every species. I have pictures or stuff like that. I have information from. For Texas horn lizards, it will take a while. They are pretty young. But since 2015, I haven't published something. So there's a lot to keep up. And bored with social media and stuff like that. It's now or never.
Totally. Yeah, completely. And now you also have a YouTube channel. There's just a couple videos on there. Is there plans in the future to expand that?
I want to expand. I already had this pretty successful YouTube channel with my model making. I was working with us as authors at the time. So I was a little bit tired on YouTube and the stuff like that. But I, with the new enclosures, I want to cover that more with Raptor Room and stuff, because those new enclosures are the closest I can get to replicate actual the desert. With my standard 4x2x2s I have standing around, it's not suitable. And I also don't recommend that for horn lizard keepers.
Sure. So you'll wait until you're very comfortable with the setup to share.
Exactly. I want to be seen as the optimal setup or a role model, more like that. I think I have the responsibility as a foreman for optimal keeping, because the species is also protected, and if we are not putting out information that they can be kept bred or help people actually achieving those, I think sooner or later, species will die out in captivity.
Yeah, yeah. No, those are great points. Well, Benjamin, you are a fascinating individual. We've only been talking for 70 minutes because you're so precise with how you speak that you just pack so much information into every sentence that it's just amazing. Is there anything that we didn't mention today that you wanted to cover before we wrap up?
There's a lot, but I guess we should make another episode some way around.
Yeah. We'll definitely have you back on because there's so much. Yeah. I think this is a good, like you said, we're kind of just scratching the surface here, getting into, you know, what you do. And then, you know, as your projects evolve, I would love to have you back on after you've reestablished those new enclosures, because that's the sort of thing that easily translates to other species as well. And people can pull from whatever they're working with and learn from that. And, you know, it's one of those things that just has more of a general base that can be helpful for people.
Absolutely. I also want to inspire other keepers for similar species or similar environments to level up their husbandry, because in a more naturalistic setup, you can see so much potential the animal has, and it's so mentally challenged to actually live in that environment with minimal interaction that it's a breeze to watch.
Do you have plans for how to observe your animals with minimal interaction?
Yeah, I have security cameras that I will place on that, and I can also observe them with spot cleaning. I have to go every day and then scoot out the fecals, and while spraying until I install a mist system. But for example, Texas horn lizards, they don't like me really much besides that one animal. They had from the previous keeper a pretty deep trauma from being grabbed from above.
Gotcha.
So a couple of days ago, put in bunch more grasses, so now they are a little bit more out, but I want the species to feel secure. It's nothing, no one is helped if the species is scared of you. I want to have them feel as much secure as possible in a closed environment without seeing me all the time.
Yeah, Yeah. I think that makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. Can you let everybody know where your Instagram page and YouTube page is, the name of it, just so they can find you?
You can find me on Instagram. It's called at Dragantas Dragons. Also throughout Facebook and YouTube. YouTube will be elevated a little bit more on in a couple of weeks, I guess, if I have the budget. But I'm most active on Instagram, where I put my pictures in and my ideas. And also feel free to look under every caption of a picture. You might find an anecdote of information there.
Awesome. Well, Benjamin, again, like I said, you're a fascinating person. You're brilliant, and you're really a good, an incredible role model for herpeticulture. This is you make it hard standards for people to live up to, which is amazing. So thank you so much for being on the podcast, and thank you for doing all the work you're doing. And we'll 100% have you back on again once you've done a little more work in that room.
Thanks for having me. Yeah. It was a pleasure to meeting you, actually. Was looking forward to it.
All right, that is the end of that episode. Benjamin, thank you so much for jumping on the podcast and doing all the work that you do. As I said to the intro, you are a gold standing member of the herpeticulture community because of how thorough you are and how just brilliant you are. And I know the listeners will think the same way. So listeners, if you enjoyed this episode, make sure you let us know in either the YouTube comments or on Spotify. If you do have any questions for Benjamin, you can always reach out to him on Instagram, or also just put them in the comments on YouTube as well, because we will definitely do another one in the future. I absolutely want to follow up with Benjamin once he has his new kind of setups created. I cannot wait to see that and hear how effective they are. And so we will do another episode in the future for sure. So if you do have any questions for him between now and then, make sure you let me know so we can cover that in the future. If you enjoyed the episode and want to share it, that goes a long way to help others learn about the show. So you can do that on Instagram or Facebook. If you would like to support us on Patreon, you can do that at patreon.com/animalsathome. I have to thank, we've had a ton of new patrons sign up recently, and it has just been so helpful for me to continue the show, to continue to run the show, and I'm so grateful for that. So thank you so much. If you would like to check out the show's sponsor, Custom Reptile Habitats, you can do that at the YouTube description, or in the YouTube description there's an affiliate link, and you can also find that same link in the show notes. If you do make a purchase using that link, a commission comes back to me at no extra cost to you, and that helps support the show as well. Until the next episode, I will catch you later.